Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. I'm the host of this show, and my name is Brady Huggett. And Happy New Year. It's a little late to be saying that, but I didn't put one out in January, so it's my first chance. Happy 2022. I hope yours is off to a good start. Mine is. It's fine. So the guest today is Ingmar Herr. He is the former CEO and a co-founder of a company called CureVac. And most likely you remember this company's name for two main reasons. One is they were in the thick of the efforts to make a vaccine against COVID-19 using messenger RNA technology. Same as BioNTech and Moderna, CureVac is an RNA company. They've always been an RNA company. They were founded as an RNA company. And they were developing a vaccine for COVID-19, which eventually failed in trials. Now, we did not talk about that on this podcast. And the reason is because Ingmar was not the CEO when those events unfolded. He stepped down from the CEO role in 2018, and he was on the advisory board, but he was no longer acting CEO. Now, the second reason you might remember CureVac, or maybe Ingmar's name, is because early in the pandemic, early in 2020, there were reports in German newspapers and also U.S. papers, including the New York Times, that then-president at the time, Donald Trump, had met with many biopharma leaders, including the CEO of CureVac, a man named Daniel Manocella, and had made overtures to buy the company, to at least buy the R&D behind the COVID-19 vaccine, to bring that to the U.S., to hoard the technology or hoard any vaccines that may be produced for Americans first or maybe Americans only. And amidst all this, Daniel was removed as CEO and Ingmar was placed back in the CEO post. And there were all these thoughts about, well, the company needs to have a German running it. There's this U.S. president is trying to buy this company and bring it to the U.S. and we need to have a German running things. None of that is true, says Ingmar. He said the plan to have him return to the CEO post had been in place for a long time. They wanted a scientist, the founding scientist, to run the company as they were trying to develop a vaccine. So we talked about that in this podcast. But also, he was only CEO in this second time for a very short period. He had a medical issue that put him into the hospital for weeks. He had a brain aneurysm. He had a long recovery after that. And we talked about that in this podcast, too, about what happens to you when you are shown your own mortality in such a specific way? When you almost die, as Ingmar did, how does that change your outlook on life? What's different on the other side? We talked about that. So all that is in this podcast. I really enjoyed this talk. He is an open-hearted man. He's loquacious. I really like talking to him. I think you'll enjoy listening to this too. And I think that's all you need to know. So here it is, your first Rounders podcast with Ingmar Herr.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Listen up.
Hello? Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, very good.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. Clear and loudly, yeah.
It's good to see you.
Yeah. So where are you placed in the States?
I'm in New York.
New York, okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. I was looking back at that paper that you wrote for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I don't even actually know, you know, where you grew up in Germany.
Well, nearby Tübingen, so not too far.
Oh, you
so
did?
I'm a,
okay.
I'm a homie, yeah.
And you were born there?
In the area. Not exactly in Tübingen, but in the area. Yeah, the Stuttgart area.
Oh, Stuttgart, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was also thinking about this, like, I wondered how you got interested in science in the first place, as far back as when you were a boy.
Well, yeah, it's just a school, you know. There wasn't any other place where I get addicted to science. It was the schooling, and it was especially chemistry and physics in the end, not biology, the primary things. But I was very interested in natural sciences. So, yeah, and this was during my full school career that I was interested in sciences. And then I decided to start biology. But that time, in the 80s, everybody was into ecology, you know, safe to nature, environmental problems, things like that. So I also was attached to this community. And I was thinking, well, let's do something in biology and protect nature. So this was the beginning. Nothing with genetics or with something like that, yeah.
So you just naturally were interested in science. Did your? I wondered if your family, anyone in your family, was in science or a professor
or
anything like that.
Yes. My uncle, Professor Engelmann, he was a professor in biorhythmics in the end, and he was also doing journeys, for example, to Greenland, where he was in dark the whole winter time in the dark,
wow,
because he wants to analyze when he takes some medications how is his rhythmics affected. So he never knew whether it's night or day. So, and this was quite fascinating to me as a young boy, hearing his stories there.
He would tell you about it, and you thought, that's the coolest thing. Yeah.
It's one of the coolest things. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Is that why you think, you know, you said you're sort of interested in the natural science in the beginning for reasons like that? You were hearing about these stories, how the body works, circadian rhythms.
Well, in the end, you know, the major impact to my decision was really nature, the nature of problems, ecology and things like that, safe nature, something like that. So I'm this was kind of a decade maybe in Germany in the 80s, 90s, where this was a hot topic for all of us, the young generation. I was also into that. I was also, you know, doing here some animal rescue things, you know, some frogs going through the streets and so to rescue the frogs before they could, because they were overthrown. So this was kind of things which I was attached to. And this was also the attempt when I started my studies in biology. You know, I was also very interested in Hans Haas, you know, the diving pioneer, the Austrian diving pioneer, Hans Haas. He was not maybe more Jacques Cousteau, Hans Haas was also very famous in Germany. He was the first guy who was diving and also bringing diving to the media. So he had a lot of movies where he was in the Red Sea with his wife. So Hans Haas also somehow put something to me where I have seen all the pictures of the sharks there and about adventure. So I was also into this marine biology at the beginning.
So, you know? He was doing like scuba diving or deep
scuba diving.
Deep
sea? Yeah. Actually, he invented scuba diving. He was the first person going with oxygen into the sea. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You said that. Yeah. You mean literally? You would be like, there's a frog in the road. We have to stop traffic and get the frog out of the road. That sort of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what's the beginning.
You've got a big heart then.
Yes, exactly. All frogs, they laughed me.
Yeah. So right. you're in high school, and you know, you're thinking like, well, I want to have a life in science. I'm going to go to college for, I don't know. Were you thinking biology at that point?
Well, yeah, it came to me during the high school that I was really attached to biology. Although, as I told you, know, natural sciences were also quite interesting for me. But I really want to get something, somehow in ecology, somehow to rescue animals, things like that. You know, this boyish thinkings, girlish thinkings about nature. So this was the beginning of my start at biology. But then, you know, when things were starting at university, I was also quite taught that, you know, I had to picture a lot of plants and things like that. I have to picture animals and things like that. So I wasn't really into this subject. So then really soon I went into microbiology and into genetics. This was more interesting to me, but it was far away from the marine biology I was up on at the beginning. Yeah.
Why was that more interesting for you?
Well, because you can't see things, you know, you have to estimate more the things, and you can also calculate more. And also interestingly, you know, I was also really interested in the dangers of these microbes, you know, in leprosy, for example, or rabies, things like that. So I was really fascinated how the human organism is fighting against the microbes. And I want to be part of it, you know, about the knowledge, how we can protect the infections and things like that. Exactly where we're in today with COVID.
Yeah. You're saying that the kind of the idea, almost like the mystery of it, you couldn't see these things with the naked eye.
No.
And that was fascinating to you, that this whole thing existed.
It was fascinating that you really have to go in and you have to, you know, you have to analyze what you see and how it counts together to get a whole picture. And this was really interesting to me, exactly, yeah.
So where did you go for your undergrad?
Well, I was always Tübingen. So as I told you, I wanted to have marine biology. So therefore, I was looking for the north part of Germany, Hamburg or Bremen, where I could study that. But we couldn't afford that. So I had to live in my parents' apartment, which was nearby Tübingen. So I started in Tübingen for this reason. So it was not by heart. It was just by the circumstances. So and then also I was used to work during holidays, university holidays. I had to work to get money for my for my studies. So therefore it was really a hard way at the beginning for me, and that was the reason why I was attaching to Tübingen. And also then Tübingen is very strong in genetics and microbiology, and also one of the reasons why I was attracted to these subjects in the end.
Right. So you thought, well, it's a good program. But also, it's close to home. I can stay at home. I can work to get money for school. Yeah.
Exactly.
What did your parents do for jobs?
Well, my father was an engineer and my mother was a housewife. So nothing special. So ordinary jobs. Yeah.
What kind of engineer?
Mittel. So he was constructing
mechanical.
Mechanical. He was constructing windows for huge buildings. This was his job. Yeah.
That's kind of cool. That's sciencey.
Yeah, especially Frankfurt. When I was a small boy, he went with me to Frankfurt where I see the skyscrapers. So it's a mini New York, you know, a mini Manhattan.
I've been there. There's a lot of new.
Yeah. And he was also involved in one of these buildings. So we went to the rooftop and I looked down and it was really fascinating what my dad is doing here. Exactly.
Cool. Okay, so you stayed right for the University of Tübingen for your PhD. You went right from undergrad into your PhD program?
Exactly. But I stayed also 1 year in India. So I wanted to get out of Tübingen somewhere in my studies. And after my diploma, I went for studies outside Tübingen. I went to Madurai Kamaraj University in Tamil Nadu, a southern state in India, where I had connections through my uncle. And they were working on leprosy, which was really interesting. So you can see they're already the sweep into medical issues back from marine bioscience into this really interesting diseases stuff. So and this leprosy project was also interesting for us because we were analyzing a lot of probes, but they also went to the villages collecting blood from patients, but also from neighbors of the patients. They want to look whether neighbors they get or healthy family contacts, whether they have antibodies in the blood. So this was was my work, collecting the blood in the villages outside of the big city of Madurai and getting back to the lab and analyzing the samples. This was interesting.
How early into your PhD program was that?
Well, this was not a PhD program. It was a practical program. It was one year exchange. You know, it was just a project, nothing for my curriculum or for my so no. This was just my personal decision. I wanted to go for 1 year to India or to this country like India, where I can do something and contribute to something with my knowledge from biology studies in Tübingen, and this was a leprosy project.
So so that's like the first time really that you'd been outside of Tübingen, maybe the first time out of Germany. I don't know.
No. After my graduation in school, 88, I went to India for 3 months already. So I was deciding, you know, I want to go alone, just my backpack and me, and going to India, a very strange country. And it was a kind of survival trip, you know. It wasn't really easy with less money. But I was really attracted to this country, and I laughed really. And I was really, somehow it was a trigger in me. So therefore, I have to go yearly, more or less yearly. No, it's not possible in COVID. But before that, I was really nearly yearly in India.
Doing
my things there. Yeah. So it's a backpack.
Every year?
Every year you would backpack. Yeah. In trains, you know, in buses, crowded buses, things like that. It was really fascinating also to see, you know, how the ordinary people live in India. Yeah, so I was also in cheap hotels because I didn't have enough money for sure. But on the other hand, I think it was fair, you know, I live like the Indians, you know, not in the Hiltons, going to the cheap hotels.
Yeah. So why do you think you wanted to do that back in 1988? It's just to see the world because you were young, you wanted to get out in the world or what?
Yeah. So somehow, yes, exactly. So I was looking for something exotic. So it could also have been the Caribbean or Australia or something like that. But somehow the flight to India was somehow affordable for me. It's not too far. I also had connections to India through my uncle.
Your uncle,
professor. Yeah. He knew some guys there, some natural scientists there in India. And the first week, also one of these guys took care of me. So it was also good kind of onboarding thing in India, which was nice. But when I was in India, I was really first of all, knowing what does it mean, you know, the culture. I wasn't really prepared for this cultural thing, you know, all the Hinduism and how people live together and also the values of the people and the poverty, exactly, you know. You mm-hmm. can really see the poverty there, which also is a big challenge for you, how to deal with that, you know. You can't help everybody, you know. You have to find your own way how to deal with the poverty around you every day, every hour. So this was, for a young man like me, this was a real challenge. And somehow I felt comfortable in this country. I also met other peoples. They disappeared very soon again. They couldn't cover this, you know. But I was, I could do that. I could live with that. I could find my own way how to deal with that. Yeah.
You mean they were sort of overcome by the culture shock?
Exactly. It was a culture shock, and they never overcome their culture shock. They could never adapt to the Indian culture, to poverty, and also to diseases, you know. Course, you get that diarrhea and things like that. So you have to be very careful, you know, and you can't avoid it in the end. Everybody gets somehow sick at least once, you know.
Yeah.
You go through to this kind of thing. So, yeah, that's... It's you know, if you meet people who've been in India, they're gonna hate it or they love it. There's nothing in between. There's nothing, you know, India, Italy, things like that. So it's really like that. They hate it or they love it.
You
love
it.
Nothing in between. I love it.
Yeah. So for you, it was, you were gonna go someplace that was not Germany, not Europe. You wanted to go someplace and see new things, wherever that was. And you landed on India because you had that uncle that could sort of help get you into the... Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So when you return from that, then you're in your PhD program. And I'm wondering how... I think if I remember correctly, you were studying under people who were already looking at RNA.
Well, actually, I... you know, I did my diploma with Hans, with Günter Jung, a chemist in at the university, because I was looking who gonna pay for my diploma thesis. You know, as a biologist, you don't normally you don't get money for that, but I needed the money because I didn't have enough money by myself. So I was looking who's gonna pay for my diploma thesis, and the only guys who could afford to pay for that were the chemists. So therefore, I went as a biologist in the chemistry department asking Günter Jung. You know, I'm a biologist, but I can maybe transfer some chemistry findings into biology. I can do that for you. Whether you want to pay for my diploma thesis. And therefore, the first project was an antifungal protein. So a protein which was against fungi. And so this was my first project. And then I stayed with Günter Jung, and then Günter Jung told me, well, in the 90s, you worked together with Hans-Georg Rammensee, immunologist. Very famous immunologist in Germany, where I discovered the peptides, MSC peptides. So Hans-Georg was isolating the peptides, and Günter Jung was analyzing the peptides, you know, and getting the sequences. So they also published in Nature the sequence of the MHC peptides, MHC class one peptides. So and this was a strong alliance, and I jumped into this, you know. So I told Günter, I work with you, but I want to get also Hans-Georg attached to me as well. So therefore, it was a kind of joint venture with me and or Günter and Hans-Georg. And then we were thinking, you know, where we can go. And Hans-Georg at that time was at a conference in the U.S. where Eli Gilboa was talking about RNA transfection of dendritic cells. So. And he was listening to this lecture, and then he came back and said, hey, Ingmar, you should do this. We should try the same, you know. We should analyze dendritic cells, then transfect dendritic cells with DNA or with RNA, and then we re-inject dendritic cells in mice. Let's do that. That's your PhD project. So I was thinking, well, okay, fine, let's jump on that. So, and then I was also thinking, and Hans-Georg told me, well, you can also use RNA as a control. You know, you can use liposome encapsulated RNA, transfect that as well, and a direct transfection into the mice. Or you can use also naked RNA as a negative control. I was doing that, you know, and this was more the key experiment where I was doing liposome encapsulated RNA versus naked RNA. And I learned that the naked RNA, the negative control, was best, exactly. So it was giving the highest immune response, higher than the liposome and trapped RNA.
You also discovered, I think, that the naked RNA was not getting broken down, which I think everybody thought it would get quickly broken down. And, exactly. And how? Why were the nucleases not doing
well,
that?
Well, yeah, it's exactly. So therefore, it was a negative control. It shouldn't work.
Right.
And so we discovered what's the reason why the RNA is stable. The reason was because of the pressure of the syringe pressure into the cells, RNA gets immediately uptaken by the cells. And once it's inside the cell, you know, it's therefore like a natural RNA stabilized. And so the thing is, the majority of the RNA gets degraded outside the cells, but the minority of the RNA gets inside the cell. It's still enough to make the protein, and that's what we measured at the end. We measured the protein. Yeah. So and also, you know, the dogma: you never should work with RNA. Okay, RNA gets decayed within seconds, and even if you breathe the air you're breathing going into these reaction cups, then RNA gets degraded. So I was also using Mundschutz in Germany, mouse protection to avoid the breathing. But in the end, you know, it's completely stable. It's nonsense. You can really work with RNA like with DNA. You can even heat up RNA much higher than any protein. You can heat it up and can boil it, you know. It's a really chemically really stable protein. And the first thing I really had to learn that chemically it's a real stable protein. So it's just because of nature. Nature is something invented to get rid of the stability of the RNA. That's the reason why RNA was regarded as unstable.
But it has to be in the cell for all these properties to be. It has to be in. Once you've got it in the cell, it's very stable. You can heat it to high temperatures, etc.
Yeah. And you have to avoid the RNAs around, you know. Of course, RNAs should be avoided. But once there's no RNAs environment, then it's really stable. It's one of the most stable proteins or molecules I ever saw somehow. And I boiled RNAs for hours, for example. I was doing just the experiment, you know, how long you can boil RNA. I boiled it maybe for 4 hours or 5 hours. It was still active at the end. So it's not degraded. Yeah.
And this became the concept that you built CureVac around, or founded CureVac around, with your two professors, correct?
with my two professors, exactly. But of course, they couldn't spend a lot of money into that venture, even either we, Florian and me, so my co-founder. So at the beginning, it was kind of a journey with money in the pockets, more or less. You know, we got a small investment from the Baden-Württemberg government for called Young Innovators. It was a kind of award for students after the university training, just to stay one or 2 years at the university and try whether the idea or something gets them to something. And this was exactly what we were doing as well. And also we had no interest at all from any venture capital company. You know, it's I don't know whether this would have been in Boston or New York area for us. We knew nothing about founding a company. You know, this was not in our culture. Actually, Germany has no founding culture. That's also something we really have to now. We have really to bring over into Europe that more and more people are thinking about founding a company and not just thinking about their own jobs in a big pharma company. But this is another topic. So for us at the university, it was really a kind of survival thing. And the first thing, because we are Swabian, and Swabian people are very strong people in Germany, so we were thinking, you know, we should sell something where we get money from. So we were thinking, well, we make customized RNA molecules, you know, for research purposes. So this was our first thing. So we created a website where everybody can now order RNA from us, the RNA people. So at that time, we were the CureVac, the RNA people, because we were service business driven.
Who are you selling to?
Well, there were some, you know, academias, because it's kind of messy to make the RNA all the time, you know. So it's easier just to purchase the RNA from somewhere. So this was the reason why people wanted to avoid that their working steps with RNA. They just wanted to go straight to their experiments with RNA. So we had customers quite a lot in whole Germany. And they gave us a sequence, and they were doing a DNA plasmid, and then we were transcribing the RNA from it, and we were sending the RNA, purifying the RNA, sending out. This was a good learning for us, to satisfy customers, you know, also if you have pressure to be timely and you'll be cost effective, things like that. So this was maybe the good thing for us, that we really had to learn it from the scratch. And it was not a big investor, you know, giving us some money and buying big cars and, hey, we are strong and we can revolutionize. Nothing like that, you know. It was really a kind of small, tiny company.
I think, you know, we've talked about this before, how this was, as you said, there wasn't a big founding culture in Germany at the time. There were not any venture capitalists, particularly ones who were interested in something that was really risky like this. There were no RNA companies. So if you go out on a roadshow trying to raise money, these venture capitalists, the few that you could find, had no interest at all.
No, not at all.
And this is a really difficult thing to found. I hate this term innovation because it's sort of overused, but this was an innovative company. Yeah. And, you know, as you said, if you'd been in Boston, it might have been different, but it's quite hard and still is quite hard to start companies like this in Germany.
Never know. It's also there that Boston is also a health community. You know, when somebody finds something interesting, everybody jumps on that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you always need a kind of scientific hero who detects something new, and then the whole crowd was jumping behind him. So I don't know whether we could have attracted this kind of hero, because nobody was interested at the time in RNA. Also in Nature, there weren't a lot of articles on therapeutic RNA at all. It was all about plasmids and DNA and adenoviruses, things like that. You know, this was the big splash, but RNA was kind of a niche, very small niche.
We're talking the late 1990s here?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I know that you had a seed investor who was going to put money in, but then pulled out. I think you said they got cold feet and pulled out. And so, you know, over and over, you're thinking, how are we going to make this thing go? We don't have any funds. And eventually you did get a venture round. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah. So first of all, you're right. So we had an angel investor, which was a devil investor in the end, because he was taking this money from one day to the other out. So we then had to get a money from the local bank here in Tübingen, the Kreissparkasse. They gave us a credit, and without the Kreissparkasse, we wouldn't have survived. You know, we would have been completely bankrupt. So this was you know, this guy was thinking, you know, maybe there's something interesting in the story, and I will go with the guys to the venture companies. And then he accompanied us to the venture companies, and then he knew the feedbacks of the venture guys saying, well, not interested, completely stupid guys, you know, young guys that they don't really know what they do and things like that. So then he got cold feet, and then he jumped out from the next day, you know. But in the end, you know, we also were crazy at that time. You know, we didn't really know anything about business and things like that, for sure.
So
I can understand.
He wasn't, I mean, he wasn't right, but he wasn't wrong either.
He wasn't right. He wasn't wrong. Yeah. But he could have killed us. And this was quite a very bad behavior, I have to say, you know.
So you went to your local bank and said, we just need money for this company we founded that we can't even really tell you what we're going to produce. And they said yes.
Well, yeah, we had to say we have to pay back this business devil. You know, we need money for paying back the guy. And they were telling us, okay, I hear you. How much you want? And I think it was maybe 100,000 euros, something like that. So not too much. But for us,
that was to pay the angel. Yeah. The devil.
So maybe
said.
He invested about 90,000 euros. I don't know exactly the amount, but it wasn't more than like that. It was kind of a really small amount.
And you spent it.
And we spent already, of course.
Yeah,
we,
right. Okay. And then you needed
all
to repay
the equipment, and we also had to some salaries and things like that. Not for us, but from our employees. So yeah, we the money was gone already. You know, there was no choice.
Oh my God.
So we went there to the bank and said, well, we have no money, and he was saying how much, you know, and then we say about 100,000, and you know, I know really the words in my mind today, but then he was looking at me and say, you're a PhD, you know, you're a biologist, well, we give you 100,000 because I'm sure you will find a job, even if Quebec is not going, you will find a job and pay us back in the next 10 years, you find a solution to pay back.
Yeah, he was right. Yeah,
he was right.
Okay, so then I know you get this. I think Leonardo Ventures gave you a little round, like 2.3 million euros or something like that, to get it going.
Yeah.
But the big deal is you met the founder of Lion Biosciences,
Friedrich. Yeah.
Yeah. So just take me through that. Who is he? I mean, for those who don't know, Lion was a huge company in Germany, like the flagship biotech company in Germany. So this person knew what biotech was.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, yes, he's also an entrepreneur and a visionaire, and he's also maybe promising a lot of things, which then not that easily happen. That's also some of the things. So, but again, as entrepreneur, it's always like that. It's a really narrow border where you jump over or not, you know. At that time, Friedrich also was punished by his stockholders because Lion was then close to insolvency, or it was insolvent, bankrupt. So, and then he disappeared from the mirror or from the spotlights here in Germany. And this was the time point when we met a lawyer of his former company, Lion, Sven Riedmüller. He's a German, but working in the U.S. He's also a university professor, I think, in Harvard. Well, I come later to that. But he's somebody, you know. He stayed in the States at that time, and he was representing Lion in the States. So this was his job. And my co-founder Wolfgang Klein, he went to the States for a kind of in investment travel and investment round, he met Sven Riedmüller somewhere at a location. And Sven told Wolfgang, we should meet Friedrich. Yeah, Friedrich is completely into new things, and he's thinking where to invest and things like that. So that was the first approach to Friedrich, where we sent a small business plan and a small story, you know. And when he came to Tübingen with his friend Chris Tanner, a friend from Switzerland, a UBS banker, it was really interesting to see him. You know, when he came to the room, he was jumping, leaving back me, and he was jumping. He was the first at the room, you know, sitting and looking like this. I don't want to see. I only want to see facts. You know, I don't want to look at you. I don't want to look at here. I want to just see facts, because he knew already that he could get attached to things, you know, and then he could exaggerate quite easily. And also his friend Chris was there to protect Friedrich from his
mind. This was exactly the reason why he was there. So, and it took me only 10 minutes really to get his eyes like this, you know, when I was saying, hey, Friedrich, we're working with RNA. RNA is like a language to the body, you know, and we could literally decode, translate everything, every protein, everything, you know. We can go into vaccines, we can go into protein replacement, we can go in everything. And we also have data there. We have data from mice, we have data from cells, you know. The only thing, we need now money to build a GMP facility to start clinical trials. That's the thing what we're looking for. And then he was really understanding this thing. He said, well, you can do everything, you know, that's a real revolution. That's a revolution. RNA is a revolution. It's the next thing, big thing to come. This was Friedrich. So, and then you know, it was clear for me that he was that's going to invest his money into CureVac.
Yeah.
First 15 minutes, it was clear to me that he was just going to do that.
So you're saying he did not want to talk. He didn't want to get caught up in the personalities in the room. He only wanted to see the science.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you found your right investor for that. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this was his assumption, but he was caught after 10 minutes. He was caught.
Yeah.
Yes. In his personal relations. Yeah.
He led you to Dietmar Hopp, another huge name in German folklore, right? This is you tell me who Dietmar Hopp was.
Yeah, he's the SAP founder, so it's a German big software company, smaller than Microsoft, but also one of the biggest and largest in Germany, or in Europe, we have to say. And he was also a garage founder, so he invented maybe like Bill Gates, the same way, you know. He invented stuff in his garage, and he grew this company to a billion company in Germany. So this is a really interesting guy. And Friedrich was, and I think he had a meeting with Dietmar Hopp, with a friend of Dietmar, who introduced Friedrich to Dietmar. And Dietmar was at a stage saying, well, I have a lot of money. I want to invest money into interesting companies. Can you help me in that, especially in biotech? I don't have a clue what biotech is, so please help me here. And that was the reason that Friedrich was scouting for companies. But this was after his meeting with CureVac. So this was after. So in CureVac, he was investing his private money in CureVac. So, and then in the next upcoming months, then he was meeting Dietmar. Dietmar. Of course, the first company he was bringing to Dietmar was CureVac. So it was quite easy for us to have this jump start when Friedrich was protecting us, and we could also then interact with Dietmar. And it's also for me quite easy to talk to entrepreneurs, you know, having also gone the rough pathway, you know, like Gates and Hop and things like that. People like
you speak
that.
The same language.
We speak the same language, you know, and I could also speak how hard it is, you know, how hard it is to get followers, you know, or get really believers in this technology. So I was really telling him, you know, it's more or less the same like SAP, you know. SAP was also knowing to nobody at the beginning. Nobody was thinking, what should we do with that stuff? And you had to really educate people for that, you know. And now it's really one of the most important computer languages everybody uses in the whole world. And the same for RNA. RNA, nobody knows about RNA, but RNA is important for every organism, for every living, for every being. Plants, animals, everybody. And there's not a lot of research out there, you know. There's no medicine out there. There's a huge potential. And I really told him that's a real revolution, although it's it's hard to tell that it is at the beginning of these things. But I have seen the picture. So then he was really looking to Friedrich, so saying, well, okay, I believe this guy. I want to invest this guy. So this was really the rebirth of the real CureVac. So then we seized all the service businesses, and then we were really focusing us on cancer. So we were starting cancer trials. Yeah.
So Dietmar Hopp basically becomes your venture capitalist. I mean, he keeps your company alive for, I don't know, 10 years or more, just putting the money in.
Yeah.
More, right? He's your main funder for 10, 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. 20 years. Yeah, we have to say 20 years. Yeah.
I think you told me he put something like maybe $100 million into that.
maybe that's a big too much, but yeah, he puts of course a reasonable sum of money, quite a lot of money into CureVac, and this was really also from the very small tiny startup into a real more or less biopharma company. This was something which was really changing the whole company. Also, yeah. There were challenges to all of us, and also in the management, we were challenged. Because we were small guys from the universities, we never built such big thing, you know. And so this was also kind of a challenge for the whole team. And also there we had to exchange people from the team always. Yeah, so it was kind of evolution in the end. But the real thing was, and the good thing is, in comparison to other VC companies, that he was a strong believer in that. You know,
yeah,
he had really a power to also to see the bad data, because the first trials they were horrible. You know, there was no outcome at all.
These are cancer trials.
The cancer trials, yeah, where you see nothing, you know, and so other investors, I don't know whether they would have continued, but Dietmar really believes in it, and he really continued.
I think I read someplace too that you mentioned, in looking back in retrospect, that you know cancer was maybe not the place to start your clinical trials. I think a lot of companies maybe do that, where they think, well, let's go after cancer because why not? It's a huge unmet need. All this, you know, cancer is such a scourge. But, you know, we don't understand it very well even today, and that it's really hard to tackle, especially with a brand new modality, like if you're studying on RNA. Yeah. You think that's true?
Yeah, completely. That's true. But there's no choice somehow, you know. You need to have some human beings to test your drug substance. And outside of cancer, it gets really hard to find volunteers or to find a disease which is not life-threatening. It's really not possible in terms of regulations. So the only so-called easy way is really to get treated cancer patients in the end of their disease. You know, you can get access to somebody who tried everything, you know, and nothing really helped. So therefore, this is some of the reasons why the regulations are much easier to fulfill in terms of new kind of drugs than really using drugs to healthy volunteers. And this was also, it wasn't really cancer, because I was also believing in vaccines in the very day, in the very beginning. And I was also believing there's a lot of things to do in the vaccine stuff. Also to mix, for example, vaccines into one drug, you know, have a one-shot vaccine for everything. And then in the end, we came up with cancer because this was easier to regulate.
I don't know. Like, I know that in 2018, you stepped down as CEO, but I don't really know how far you were in your clinical programs at that point.
Well, 2018, we had some clinical phase two data in cancer, prostate cancer, for example. But again, this data, they weren't really compelling as they should. So we were kind of in a depression, how to continue, you know, what next, and what's the right cancer indication where I should go. And also, you know, using the vulnerable cancer patients treated a lot with radiotherapy, chemotherapy, you know, and one of the reasons was also that it was difficult for them to mount any immune response anymore. We could also measure that, you know. We had to find a way how to get to healthy volunteers. And this was also one of the reasons why we adapted rabies as one of the programs, I think 7 years back, something like that. Because in rabies, it was clear we can measure an immune response. It's possible. We can use also healthy volunteers, you know. It's a clear defined vaccine where we also can have a control with a rabies vaccine on the market. So this was one of the reasons why we switched to rabies. It was not a product, but it was a kind of proof of concept vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you were in 2018? You had the phase two readout for your, refractory prostate cancer, I'm assuming.
Yeah, we had also non-small cell lung cancer and prostate cancer. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Because the last time you and I spoke, you were still CEO. Did you take a step back from CEO, or did you leave the company completely?
At that time, because we thought, you know, we should have a stronger presence in the U.S. Since we were also we were knowing that we need more money, and the thing is whether we in Germany can really have enough money to get to an IPO stage where we should go. So that was the reason why we hired them in Nigella from the US. And also we had a US branch, or we still have it, in Boston.
Yeah.
Where Dan Minichella was staying. And this was the plan at that time, that Dan Minichella should do the CEO directing the German branch from the US branch in Boston. And then Dan was leading us to the next steps. Yeah. And then there was the COVID thing. And so this was in March 2020. And at that time point, I was asked by the supervisory board whether I want to jump back to the CEO position, because there was a lot of knowledge needed now from science space. Yeah. And then Minichella wasn't into the RNA space. He was a good business guy.
Yeah.
But now the scientific perspective was more needed in the beginning. So this was a decision to step back as a CEO, where I was less than one day in the end in this role.
Right. So, but you were still with CureVac. You were just not CEO. You were CSO, or what was your role?
No. I was in the advisory supervisory
on the board.
I was the head of the supervisory board.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So just to be clear, like, there's all this stuff that was in the papers around this, okay? And it was all, so it's these rumors that Donald Trump was going to buy CureVac and move it to the U.S. and all the vaccines would go to U.S. This was reported in the German papers. CureVac said this isn't true. CureVac said basically what you just said, that we're about to go into a really heavy scientific period for this company. We want our founding scientists back to run it. And that's what
exactly.
You said too, right?
Exactly. It was just a coincidence that he met Donald Trump, but the decision was before that already taken in the supervisory board.
Yeah, I remember seeing that and thinking, no. Well, look, I don't know what's true or not, but I remember thinking, well, no, that's the founding scientist they're putting back as the CEO of this company.
Exactly. That's really the issue. That it was everything, you know, every head's back to the rudder, and the founder has to be on the rudder now and steering the whole company. That was the reason why this was decided. Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember it being a huge mess in the papers. I mean, New York Times is on it, but. And so then you become CEO, but what happens after that?
Well, I was just only one day CEO, and then I went to Berlin, where we were in discussions with the government about the COVID strategy, like also the others as well. Uğur was also there. So they were talking to us, you know, what can we do in terms of RNA vaccines to tackle the COVID outbreak in Germany. So this was the reason. And in the night, because there was a huge pressure on me, I had a bleeding in my brain, an aneurysm, you know, and I was unconscious in the morning. And my assistant Marina was trying to call me in the early morning, because there was some kind of topic she wanted to talk to me, and she couldn't reach me. So therefore, she was calling the hotel staff, and they found me then in the hotel room, unconscious. So
in bed,
yeah, completely unconscious, and I was there more than 1 month in this kind of coma situation
in Berlin.
In Berlin, yeah.
So they took you right to the hospital.
Yeah,
and that a medically induced coma?
It was a medical induced coma, yeah. And also they had to stop the bleeding in the brain. So I get also some ruptures in the brain, and I get some surgery there as well. So yeah, it was really tough. So I think my survival perspective was about 13%, something like that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 95% chance of death.
Oh my God. So they don't know how long you were. They don't know how long after the your aneurysm burst that you were in bed before they got it. It's hours, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. My wife got a telephone call the same day, and they told my wife she should come immediately to Berlin. They don't know whether I'm still alive at the evening, so she should rush to see me alive.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was very bad.
Do you have any memory of that month at all?
No. I even don't have a memory, you know, at the Berlin time, what we did in Berlin, what we were talking about in terms of the RNA vaccines.
Before
COVID. Before that, even that, it's black. I don't know what I was doing in Berlin. Yeah.
I read, so I was trying to do some research, and I came across, this is a German paper, so the translation to English might not have been great, but that you were in the hospital, and because of all the importance of CureVac, that they were using a pseudonym for you in the hospital.
Yeah,
And they Paul were calling Kern. You by a different name. What was the name?
Paul Kern.
Paul Kern,
yeah. Paul Korn.
And so they were calling you that, and you were like, you didn't know, like, why are these people calling me? Almost, who am I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was kind of a really bad situation. I lost my name. I lost my personality. Who am I? You know, am I Ingmar Hör? What is my role in life? You know, did I found a company, and what's the name of the company? And yeah, it was really critical to me. And I was really thinking, you know, my personality is gone. There's nothing left for my personality. So and this was because they were using this acronym. They're not my real name. This was also because they had a Russian accent. So there were a lot of Russian people helping in the hospital. So and I was really thinking, well, I must be in Moscow with the KGB, you know. So I'm hostage of the KGB in Moscow. Could have been by the end, you know. I never know.
And there's no, like, you're so in and out of it that there's no time for someone to really talk to you and say, here's what's going on. No, you're just sort of floating in and out.
Yeah, exactly, floating in and out. I'm sure they tried to reach me somehow, but it was not going into me, you know. So I was really, and also, yeah, I couldn't talk because there was a catheter here in inside.
A tube.
Breathing tube inside. And my wife was there, but I could recognize her. So I knew that she was my wife. And I was really whispering to her, bring mich raus, die bring mich um. So... Get me away from here because they murder me, you know. They murder me, you know. They're behind me. So and you are my wife. You have to rescue me from here. So I was ordering.
I mean, I have to say that must have been terrifying for your wife,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
So you're a month in the hospital recovering from that. Mm-hmm. How long? So my grandfather had an aneurysm and burst, and it took him a very long time to recover. I mean, this was obviously decades ago, but. But how long did you have to recover once you're out of the hospital?
Well, the black phase was at the beginning, maybe for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, something like that. And then I recovered slowly. And then I also knew that I was the founder of CureVac, and I was also into the news of CureVac. I was reading the newspapers and things like that. This was after 6 weeks or eight weeks. But then, you know, it was a long process. I was also then put into another hospital, in a recovery hospital in Berlin. And then I was put also to Lake Constance, into a rehabilitation hospital, where I do some rehab functions. I was doing sport, and I was doing mind training and things like that. So this lasted quite a long time before I could go back to Tübingen, to my family. Yeah, half a year, something like that.
Oh, 6 months. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, obviously if you are in a coma, you're laying down all the time, your body, you know, all the muscles get weak and atrophy. Yeah. So you had to recover the whole thing. You had, as you said, do exercises. And I mean, did you have to relearn to walk or all those things or no?
Yeah. I was in a wheelchair in Berlin. So really I had to learn again to walk and also get enough strength and powers to go steps and things like that, forth and back. It like a child of 4 years age, you know. I really had to do everything again. Also to eat, because I couldn't eat because of this here. Uh-huh. So it was all a learning. Everything I learned again.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, you know, having met you before, that you seem very much the same as you were the first time I met you. So that must have been a long way back.
It's a long way. It's still there. It's still a way to go. But I'm really grateful to everybody, to the clinicians, to the doctors, to my wife. They were really doing a good job with me, and they also were resilient because I'm not an easy guy. So I was also claiming things, and I was also thinking, well, maybe it's better to die because I don't want to live like that. You know, I kind of this depression phase. That's also natural.
Yeah, that's natural, you know, right?
That's natural that you get into this depression phase. But On the other hand, I'm also a fighter, you know. I'm always a fighter. It was like the beginning of CureVac when it wasn't accepted that we get into bankruptcy, so we have to do something. And the same was for my own bankruptcy, you know. It's not accepted to die. I need to survive, you know. And now let's survive. Let's do everything to survive. And now let's do everything to get back to the guy I know. And I like this guy, you know, the old Ingmar. So I want to get again back the same personality again. So and I really feel that there's a pressure in me that I really have to fight for that. And that's something which maybe saved my life as well during the hard thing when I had just this 20% chance to survive. That in me there was already the fighter going to the war and fighting against the death. Yeah.
So, I mean, because, you know, you're weeks in a hospital, you're weeks laying down, just laying there with the tube in your throat. And, you know, as you said, people get like, what kind of life is this? To be laying in a bed forever. I don't want this life. And you're saying you felt that, but you're like, I have to get back to that old person that I was.
Yeah, and also my wife told me during this phase, maybe the first 6 weeks when I could talk through this catheter, I was saying, hey, you know, you have to rescue me. You have to find a way to get out of the hospital. You know, you should put me in a trolley. You know, you should go to the elevator with me, and we should avoid, you know, the guards at the entrance. You know, how we can avoid the guards and things like that. So I was really like, how I can do that? How I can get out of this? You know. It was really messy because I still have this fantasy that this is KGB, it's Russia. Yeah, it's Russia. They're all criminals, you know, and it's not a good feeling, I can tell you.
No. You know, this so like the one given of life is that everybody dies, right? We know that, but we know it in sort of like a opaque way, a vague way. But when something like this happens, it has a way of sort of specifically showing, you know, your own mortality. And often after that, people have a completely different outlook on life. And I'm wondering if that happened to you.
Yeah, sure. It comes now a bit. So the first stage of it was really to fight, you know. I want to get back. I want to get back to the person I was, and so. And the thing is really how to accept it, that you have deficits, and how you can accept this new role. And now I'm in the phase now really thinking about, well, what's the great reason for life, you know, where you want to go, what are the next goals, where I should go, what's family, what's love, and things like that. And also, these topics I dismissed for a long time. You know, I have twin boys; they are now 6 years old. And if you tell me, you know, how were these boys when they were babies? I can't tell you because I wasn't there in Tübingen. I was really traveling around the world. You know, and also I have no physical, psychological attachment to these babies because it's CureVac. That's my first son. And then the twins, they're my second son, you know, and the first kid, CureVac needs a lot of help and protection. So I was really struggling a lot to go with CureVac. It was really a baby of me. I really felt it. In contrast, the boys, they didn't get the love they deserved from me, you know. And also Sarah was telling me, you know, you never looked up, you know, you never look up our boys. I'm as a mother, you know, I was alone the whole time, you know, and you were traveling around. You're not attached to the guys. And this now changed a lot, you know. I really feel attached. And now I learned these guys, you know, what kind of personalities they have. And I really liked them. And I really felt in love with these guys. So that's a good thing of aneurysm.
It flipped it. The kids and family came above the business now.
Yeah. So
they're
now
twins,
CureVac
huh?
CureVac gets in the background, and now the twins there are where they should be. Yeah.
Yeah. At the top, right?
At the top, yeah.
I read too that when you finally had recovered enough, you know, your 6 months of coming back from this aneurysm, that you went into CureVac. And they all sort of were like, just sort of clapping that you had made it back to the company.
Yep. This was the IPO afternoon. Yeah. This was great. Yeah. So I was invited to come to the IPO functions. Also, there was Dietmar Hopp not in persons, but from the computer space, from the laptop.
Yeah.
And Yeah, and he was also saying, well, it's nice to have me back. You know, that's really one biggest beyond the IPO for sure. But then the next topic is also that Ingmar is back. Yeah, that was really good. This was heart-taking.
Yeah. So you were, you're done with CureVac, and you started something called the Morpho Organization. Tell me what that's about.
That's the Morpho Foundation, yeah. I decided, you know, in my heart, I'm an entrepreneur, and even not a pharma manager. You know, steering the big ship like CureVac, it's not really my role. So I'm really an entrepreneur. I really want to be narrow to people working with. I want to be narrow to projects I understand, and I want to steer these projects. So therefore, the Morpho Foundation is a reinvention of CureVac in another scope. And I got a bit money from CureVac, and also we said, well, we don't need all the money for our private reasons. We have enough all for the kids. We have enough to live and things like that. So we will do something good with the money, and that was the reason to found the Morpho Foundation together with Florian von der Mülbe, who is my co-founder of CureVac. So here you can see it's just the next thing, you know. It's like CureVac again. So we are a small team. We are about 6-7 people sitting together, talking about what we're doing, where we go, and this spirit I really like, and the spirit also I missed in the huge ship like CureVac. It was hard for me, you know, to get attached to all the projects they were doing. Yeah.
Right. So now this is smaller. You're focused
really smaller,
on it.
Now, and now you can really feel how does it feel, you know, how you can interact and how you can decide things. And the whole thing is also that we are not dependent on money. You know, in CureVac, we always were dependent on investors. That's also something which narrows your space. If you always need to discuss things and discuss projects and find arguments and things like that, which is good, of course, it directs you in the right direction, maybe. But on the other hand, it's also bad because some of the decisions are not the right decisions, and you can see it just later. But and here it's like that. You know, we can drive it where we want to have it and drive it, and we discuss it together with Florian and his wife and with Sarah and me together, sitting there, and we decide, well, so should we spend the money for here or should we spend the money for there? So that's freedom. And exactly, freedom is also the most important basis of my life, you know, being free. Something which was not really in CureVac, where it's not like jail, but kind of, you know, people were telling all the time what I should do and where should I go. And now after 20 years CureVac, it's the first time again that I'm free as I was in my studies, where we started the discussion today, I could really freely decide what I do, what I should go, and things like that. And now after 20 years, I'm just back at the same position. And this makes me really happy, and this makes me really strong, being my own guide again.
Yeah. So you started Morpho with your wife. You did it together.
With my wife and with Florian and his wife.
Right. And so the aim of it is to try to, it seems like to me, to bring art and science to underprivileged children.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's a mixture because, you know, Florian and I'm into science. And the first attempt was that we think, well, we should go with COVID, you know, and we should really try to get access to CureVac's COVID vaccines, and then also to distribute these vaccines in underprivileged regions and things like that. But it's, you know, we are not linked to CureVac anymore, and also CureVac has these problems, so I don't have to speak further. So therefore, we switched and say, well, we do something other in health things. And we also want to, and my wife, she was at the opera in Stuttgart. She was the press referent in Stuttgart. And so she's really into culture. So we will see how we can bring both things together, culture and health. And this is now the journey we're into, that we will invest a lot into health being of children, for example, of underprivileged families, that they can also do sport, for example. They can do a lot of culture. They get into theater projects, and they work on mental health, for example. They get into contact with animals and things like that. So it's just the beginning, and we are just looking for pathways where to go, and also how we can distinguish to other foundations. But it's really fun to do that. Yeah. So also in terms of projects, international projects, we are also into Africa, Uganda, for example. Yeah. Going in these regions and
India.
Try to help. also India, we urgently wanted to go to India, going directly there and visiting the people and visiting the projects during the Omicron. It's not possible this time, but we will then further on, we will do that. And then we will decide what kind of projects we want to invest in. Yeah, India as well. Yeah.
And I should say, this was just founded last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you sort of just at the beginning stages, building it again, as you said.
Exactly. And some small projects we are now into these days. Yeah.
That's all I had. This is really good. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah, hold on. Hold on. I'll stop this recording. Hold on.
Yeah.
Okay, there it is, your first Rounders podcast with Ingmar Herr. Many thanks to Ingmar for taking the time and letting me pick his brain and talking about those harrowing aspects of his life. Amazing story. So what else? Well, okay, if you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do it wherever you find podcasts. Just search for Nature Biotechnology and First Rounders. You can also subscribe to our sister podcast, Forum, and our 10-part serial podcast on Stan Crook, the history of antisense, and the terrible disease, spinal muscular atrophy. That is called Hope Lies in Dreams. You can also find that wherever you find your podcasts and off the homepage of Nature Biotechnology. If you'd like to reach us, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Nature Biotech. And I think that is all. That's the end of my housekeeping. I will talk to you in the next one. Thank you and goodbye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.